You're listening to the RBN Energy Blogcast. This is an audio version of RBN Energy's daily blog, the oil and gas industry's go-to source for insight. Every day, we cover commodity fundamentals, industry changes, and developing trends across energy markets. And now, we're making it easier than ever to enjoy our blogs. Whether it's on your drive into work, while you're at the office, or at home walking the dog, settle in, turn the volume up, and enjoy.
Thursday, July 15, 2021. Different Strokes for Different Folks, Part 2. How the FERC Sets Oil and Gas Pipeline Rates. Published by Rick Smead. The uninitiated might be forgiven for thinking that oil and gas pipeline operations are similar. After all, they're just long steel tubes that move hydrocarbons from one point to another, right? Well, that's about where the similarity ends. While the oil and gas pipeline sectors are interlinked, they developed in quite distinctly different ways, and that's led to a vast chasm in both the way the two are regulated and how their transportation rates are determined. Bridging that gap between oil and gas can be a perilous and chaotic endeavor because you've got to consider how each sector evolved over time and then the separate sets of rules that have been established to form today's competitive marketplace. In today's blog, we continue our review of oil and gas pipelines and how their separate histories led to the current differences in pipeline rate structures. In Part 1, we discussed how crude oil and natural gas pipeline regulation in the U.S. developed. Both sectors have been under the purview of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, since the 1970s. Oil pipeline oversight by the federal government started with the enactment of the Hepburn Act of 1906, which modified the Interstate Commerce Act, adding oil pipelines to the list of the Interstate Commerce Commission's, or ICC, concerns. The ICC's primary focus was on providing producers with common carrier access to crude-carrying pipelines. Federal regulation of natural gas pipelines didn't kick in until 1938 with the enactment of the Natural Gas Act, or NGA, which put regulation of gas pipelines in the hands of the Federal Power Commission, or FPC, an entity that was created in the 1920s to regulate interstate electricity transactions. The Energy Organization Act of 1977 transformed the FPC into the FERC, which also became responsible for the regulation of oil pipelines. That's pretty much how it's been ever since, though the Energy Policy Act of 1992 made some revisions to how FERC regulates oil pipelines. What we didn't delve into last time was natural gas pipeline regulation. Nor did we explain how the actual agency-level regulation of oil pipelines has worked out. Today, we will start with the gas side and come back to oil regulation in the next part. As we said in our previous blog, by the late 1930s, natural gas pipeline development was taking off, but gas midstreamers faced the challenge of reconciling the different sets of laws and rules for each state that their pipelines traversed, and being long and skinny, that was a lot of states. For example, an upstream state could actually find ways to swipe gas from a downstream state. So as part of his New Deal, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, seeing that this was an important interstate activity, got the Natural Gas Act of 1938, or NGA, passed, providing a detailed regulatory structure, custom designed for interstate natural gas pipelines. The NGA was to be administered by the FPC. Not much happened at the FPC until after World War II, when the gas industry saw rapid growth. Gas pipeline capacity had been expeditiously built out during the war, and at least one major oil pipeline, Texas Eastern, built to protect U.S. oil from Nazi U-boats, wasn't needed as an oil pipeline after the war and had been converted to natural gas. The market was awash with capacity, and the cost of taking on new customers was very low. So, pipelines were acquiring customers hand over fist, without adding much to their costs. The NGA has two key rate-making sections, Section 4 and Section 5. Section 4 governs pipeline filings for rate increases, while Section 5 governs commission investigations and potential reductions in rates to align with cost of service. Pretty much all the rate proceedings in the 1950s and 1960s involve Section 5 investigations. With new revenues far larger than new costs, gas pipeline owners were not eager to go to the FPC. So there were very few cases involving Section 4 requests from pipeline owners for rate increases. That would soon change, though. Back then, and until 1993, as we'll get to, gas pipelines were the buyers and sellers of natural gas. You read that right. Not only did pipelines transport the gas, they were the marketers of that gas. They bought the vast bulk of the molecules that entered their systems from producers and sold those molecules to local distribution companies, power utilities, and a few industrial companies on the delivery end, at bundled rates that covered the cost of the gas itself, the transportation of the gas, and the storage of the gas. The wellhead price of gas sold to interstate gas pipelines was regulated by the feds as well, based on cost of service, not on market value. On the other hand, gas that stayed within the state where it was produced, i.e., sold to or transported on intrastate pipes for in-state consumption, was largely priced at market. The feds held prices low, while the intrastate gas was able to command much higher prices. As you might guess, this led to severe price dislocations with volumes held out of interstate gas markets so they could be sold as intrastate gas. By the late 1960s, it became really hard to buy interstate natural gas, leading to shortages in many non-producing states because gas producers were highly motivated to sell the gas in the state in which it was produced. During this period, the regulated price of natural gas in interstate markets was one-fifth the price of gas sold within the state where it was produced, usually Texas or Louisiana. An example might be 52 cents per thousand cubic feet for interstate gas versus $2.50 per thousand cubic feet in the intrastate market. This compelled the owners of interstate pipelines to seek gas supply from the federally controlled deeper waters of the Gulf of Mexico. They built enormous offshore systems to get gas that was priced at the lower, federally regulated prices, and that came along as a byproduct of oil production. Altogether, interstate pipelines' costs soared, but despite their efforts to secure more gas, their throughput started to fall off due to lack of supply. This meant interstate pipeline rates had to go up a lot to cover the larger cost of their systems over a smaller volume base. The first repair that Congress attempted was in the Natural Gas Policy Act of 1978, which created 27 different pricing categories for interstate gas, ranging from about 40 cents to about $7. So prices for interstate gas went from the static but too low levels that had caused the shortages to ricocheting all over the place. There were many arduous gas pipeline gas cost and rate proceedings at FERC and in court, and at least one major pipeline system went bankrupt because of economic problems over its gas supply costs. This was the kind of massive dysfunction that makes lawyers' and experts' careers. However, following decades of fits and starts toward deregulation, there was a soup-to-nuts natural gas regulatory transformation in the late 1980s and early 1990s. In 1989, Congress passed the Wellhead Decontrol Act, and in 1993, FERC Order No. 636 brought about a restructuring of the industry, taking pipelines out of the gas buying and selling business. Under the new rules, pipelines were forced to separate their transportation and sales services from each other. Producers, marketers, industrials, pretty much anybody could buy and sell gas on a pipeline, using the pipeline's transportation services without regulation of the gas commodity price. The pipelines themselves weren't so lucky. Transportation and storage rates reverted to the basic bread-and-butter regulation of the cost-of-service model, which was the standard for pipeline rates under the by-then 55-year-old NGA, for recovering operating and capital-related costs of the pipelines. With the gas commodity pricing out of the picture, leaving only transportation cost regulation, rate cases got a lot simpler. Gas pipeline cost of service, or cost of doing business, is generally a simple accounting-based measure of the pipeline's actual costs for the previous year and its provable changes for the next 9 months. There is very little that's mushy about the method, although with the army of lawyers and experts who made, and make, their living off the process, there are still a lot of complexities. Section 4 gas pipeline rate cases, in which pipelines seek higher cost of service assessments, and Section 5 rate reviews where pipelines must justify their rates, are now a lot less frequent than they used to be. So it's not uncommon these days for a pipeline company's rate department to be staffed with people who have never filed a rate case. It's a relatively easy system to learn, with a crisply tailored statute, regulations to fill in the details, and a huge body of law to help FERC commissioners determine case outcomes. Oil pipeline rate determinations are very different, regulated under a different statute, albeit by the same regulator, under different rules and with higher degrees of flexibility but lower predictability. More on that later, in our next installment. Everyday People was written by Sly Stone and appears as the first song on side 2 of Sly and the Family Stone's fourth studio album, Stand. Released as a single in November 1968, the song went to number 1 on both the Billboard Soul Singles and Billboard Hot 100 Singles charts. It was the first number 1 single for the band. With its lyric of different strokes for different folks, the song is a call for peace and equality for different races and social groups. That lyric became a popular catchphrase in modern culture and would later inspire the name of the hit television series, Different Strokes. San Francisco's Sly and the Family Stone, along with Los Angeles rock band Love, were the first integrated rock bands to have albums out. Sly and the Family Stone also featured two women in the group, Rose Stone and Cynthia Robinson. Everyday People is one of the most covered songs by Sly and the Family Stone, with artists such as Aretha Franklin, Joan Jett, the Staple Singers, and Pearl Jam recording the song. Personnel on the record were Sly Stone on vocals, Rose Stone, on vocals and keyboards, Freddie Stone, on vocals and guitar, Larry Graham, on vocals and bass, Greg Errico on drums and vocals, Jerry Marini, on sax and vocals, and Cynthia Robinson, on trumpet and vocal ad-libs. Stand was recorded in 1968 and 1969 at Pacific High Recording Studios in San Francisco, with Sly Stone producing. Released in May 1969, the album went to number 3 on the Billboard Top R&B chart and number 13 on the Billboard Top 200 album chart. It has been certified platinum by the Recording Industry Association of America. Two singles were released from the album. Stand was selected by the Library of Congress for inclusion in the National Recording Registry. Sly and the Family Stone were an American soul and rock band formed in San Francisco in 1966 by Sly Stone. Sly was already a popular DJ and record producer in the Bay Area when he put the band together. The original band was active until 1975, when internal problems led to their dissolution. Sly Stone retired from the music business in 1987. The group released 11 studio albums and 40 singles. The band left a strong impression after their appearance at the Woodstock Music Festival in 1969 and are featured in the film and soundtrack of that historical event. 18 people passed through Sly and the Family Stone until its final breakup. The work of the band greatly influenced the sound of American funk, soul, pop, R&B, and hip-hop music. The band was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1993 and the Vocal Group Hall of Fame in 2007.
This has been the RBN Energy Blogcast. Thanks for listening.